This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
Unruly, a history of England's kings and queens. Written and read by me, David Mitchell. Introduction. There was a moment in 1940, the bleakest year of the Second World War, with the Wehrmacht carrying all before it, when Winston Churchill made the French government a curious offer. He suggested a merger of the British and French states. He said we could be one country for the duration of the war, the flames of our dual sovereignties would be kept alight in one state, and then, Hitler having been defeated, we could demerge and carry on. This sort of thing is typical of Churchill. It's a big, quirky idea, and he was a big believer in ideas. He had a lot of them, and he was drawn to other people who had them. Most of us probably think we're believers in ideas too, but we're deluding ourselves. Believing in ideas is one of those attributes like libido or skill at driving a car that most people reckon they possess in above-average quantities, but that's mathematically impossible. Admit it. Ideas can be annoying and frightening and threatening, and most of us slightly shudder whenever someone has one. The internet was an idea. So were self-service tills in supermarkets and privatising water companies and stuffed crusts. Ideas aren't all lovely vaccines. They can be a right pain. We all like some ideas that have already been had, normal pizza, dishwashers, freedom of speech, but we don't put much faith in those that are yet to emerge. We generally think that a problem is what it is and needs to be addressed in one of the established ways that have been handed down for addressing it. And we're usually right. When a pipe has burst, you need a plumber, not a glittering-eyed futurologist saying, "What if we could construct a world where we didn't need water?" Churchill was different. He'd give that proponent of water obsolescence a fair hearing and a modest research budget. On Churchill's watch, Britain was a great power, becoming increasingly strapped for resources. For Russia or America, the solution could always be more troops or more money. Britain, on the other hand, was on the lookout for deft ways of keeping up geopolitical appearances, and a clever new idea always held out that hope. Hence, during the First World War, in the face of the Western Front's murderous deadlock, Churchill championed the idea of attacking Turkey. I think this was actually quite a sensible plan. The knackered old Ottoman Empire was a far feebler military opponent than Germany or even Austria-Hungary. Sadly, however, the resultant Gallipoli campaign of 1915 was a fiasco that left Allied dead lying thickly along the Aegean coastline like a macabre khaki pastiche of holiday-making customs to come. It was more a screw-up of execution than of conception, but it nevertheless shows that thinking outside boxes can sometimes result in thousands of young men getting buried in them. By 1940, several loop-the-loops later in Churchill's rollercoaster career, he was hoping this new idea would somehow prevent the surrender of France, even if it were to be militarily defeated. If two become one, as the Spice Girls put it, in a song that weirdly turns out not to be about the proposed Anglo-French merger at all, but just about having sex, then both Britain and France would have to be defeated before either of them could be. That was what Churchill reckoned. The French turned down the offer. Perhaps it felt like a proposed British takeover. That might not have appealed to them at a time when resisting a German takeover was their focus. My suspicion is, though, that they simply didn't see the point of it. They had no sense that their nationhood was dependent on the mere continuity of political organs. They'd had three monarchies, two empires, and three republics in the previous 150 years. They've had two more republics since. They knew that the state can be crushed and occupied, and yet the country, the nation, some sense of a thing that is France, will continue to exist. The English feel differently about themselves. Vera Lynn may have sung "There'll Always Be an England," but she can't have been certain, or it wouldn't have been worth claiming. Just as when someone promises, "You'll be all right," the implication of jeopardy is clear. But what was actually threatening England, as in the geographical entity, the densely populated section of a small island? Nothing. The song was released in 1939, so predates any fears of nuclear Armageddon, and our current concerns about the climate and rising sea levels were decades in the future. Physically, Lynn must have known, England was bound to endure, the ravages of the Blitz notwithstanding. England might be made to suffer pain and indignity. Many of its people might die, but of course it would remain, just like the sea and the sky. So when Lynn or Churchill referred to England, they weren't just thinking about the place and its people. Their England was a different sort of thing from a Frenchman's France. To the French, Churchill's idea was nonsensical. The notion that the structure of a state, a constitution, could be a more effective vessel for Frenchness than the vast land of France was absurd. German soldiers might march all over it, but that didn't make it Germany. It would remain, whatever happened to it, France. To Lynn and Churchill, England's existence was inextricably linked to the continuity of its institutions. And at this point, it has to be said, when a British statesman said England, he often meant Britain. The near eclipse of the ancient Kingdom of Scotland in the British establishment's sense of national continuity is another thing that might have made the French hesitate before agreeing to Churchill's merger. The UK, the establishment assumption would have been, was primarily England. And England was predominantly not its fields, valleys, lakes, poetry, music, cuisine or folk art, but the pillars of its constitution. Its empire, its church, its ancient noble families, its parliament, and, first and foremost, its monarchy. For England to always be, those things must always be too. Monarchy is what England has instead of a sense of identity. The very continuity of English government, the rule of kings morphing into the flawed parliamentary democracy of today, has resulted in our sense of nationhood, patriotism, and even culture getting entwined with an institution that, practically speaking, now does little more than provide figureheads. This has become clearer in the last few years. Britain has been feeling pretty low about itself. Fear, anger, and poverty have been on the rise. The only events that have allowed us to pause even briefly in the constant mutual recrimination that the situation has aroused have been the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, then her death and funeral, and then the coronation of a new king. These were the occasions that brought us together and, albeit with varying levels of irony and cynicism, allowed us to celebrate our existence. We seem to need the trappings of monarchical continuity in order to reflect contentedly upon ourselves, just as we need alcohol in order to socialise. The English have more to fear from republicanism than most. We risk losing our skimpy sense of self. It seems subtly different with Scotland, Wales, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the various other places England currently shares its monarchy with. And less subtly different with most other countries, where they've had revolutions and changes of constitution lots of times and learned the largely happy lesson that they didn't lose their whole identities when they stopped having kings or gave their assemblies new names. The English tradition of kings and queens has a lot riding on it and a lot to answer for. Its longevity and the stability that that implies has resulted in an England that doesn't have much else uniting it. Simply because the monarchy has never been removed, except for a brief experiment in the middle of the 17th century, we've never been forced to work out what else we might be other than a kingdom. What do we stand for, really? Freedom and democracy? Tradition and hierarchy? Bad food and sarcasm? Traffic and disappointment? Ships and factories? Rain and jokes? We've never agreed on anything, and the royal family have long since stopped taking the lead. They just smile and keep it vague. This was the late Queen's greatest talent, being the screen onto which everyone was invited to project their own views. I don't really mean this as a criticism. I'm not sure it's healthy for a state to proclaim a unified sense of self. I used to enjoy feeling slightly contemptuous of the French and American habit of sticking their flags everywhere as if they can't get over themselves. We didn't do that in Britain. Then Boris Johnson announced, in his desperation to stoke nationalistic fervour to distract from his government's manifest failings, that the Union Jack must now be flown on the country's every available pole, and that small pleasure was denied me. The fact is that when millions of people are involved, any sense of a nation united in its values can only be portrayed by repressing the feelings and views of many. Humans don't often agree, and it achieves nothing to pretend that they do. Genuine consensus is rare, and open disagreement beats fake consensus. Whenever politicians mention British values, it's only ever to trick us, to flatter us with the thought that we're all paragons of liberty, fair play, common sense, justice, opportunity, or some other concept that virtually no one outside Iran and North Korea would fail to pay lip service to. Still, as we become less comfortable about our imperial past, and as Scotland and Wales seek solace in their own distinct cultural identities, the majority of Great Britain's citizens, the English, are left puzzling over what they're supposed to feel collectively. The ferocious interest that many of us are taking in the rift between Harry and Meghan on the one hand, and Charles, Camilla, William and Kate on the other, may be a side effect of this. Are we hoping that in that row we can find some answers? Is that why, even though it's just a family quarrel among strangers, we're drawn to it as if it's a soap opera made of crack? We look to the royals because we look to the past, and royalty emerged from the past. England's identity is England's history. More than with any other nation I can think of, the two concepts seem synonymous. Leaders talk of the future, about becoming a modern, thrusting, caring superpower of enterprise or greenness or science or education, and we nod along. But who really feels that's what England is? As I confront my own puzzled sense of national identity, I have reached for the best way of explaining my own people and people in general, and that's history. So this book may be about all the kings and queens who ruled England, and it's mainly kings, the olden days being, among many, many, many other flaws, extremely sexist. But it's not really about the past. It's about history. History, the school subject, the hobby, the atmosphere, the wonky drawings of kings, the grist to heritage's mill that's been converted into a cafe, the sense of identity. History is a very contemporary thing. It's ours to think about, manipulate, use to win arguments or to justify patriotism, nationalism or group self-loathing, according to taste. In contrast, the past is unknowable. It's as complicated as the present. It's an infinity of former nows, all as unfathomable as this one. That's why historians end up specialising in tiny bits of it. For England in particular, history is about who we collectively are and how we feel about it. It's one of the attempted answers to the great human question, what the hell is going on? Most animals don't ask that question, which is why you can put a massive IKEA next to a field of sheep and they just keep on grazing. Not even 20 minutes of bleats and gestures and questioning looks. They're just not interested. But a vast amount of human endeavour is an attempt to answer it in different ways. All the sciences and all the humanities, microscopes, philosophies, expeditions, religions and poems are all having a go. Of all those attempted answers, history is the one I reach for first. After all, if you walk into a room and someone's standing on a table waving a gun, and someone else is having a wee in the fireplace, and there's an enormous bowl of trifle in the middle of the floor in which a terrier has drowned, and on the TV it's 9 minutes into a DVD of One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing, and you ask that great human question, then the best answer is history. What happened before is the best explanation of what happened next. It's more pertinent than getting into how dogs evolved, or the functioning of the human kidney, or the economics of 1970s cinema. This book, then, is an anecdotal attempted explanation of England, focusing on what I find most interesting. More often than not, that has something to do with a person wearing a sparkly metal hat. If you think that sounds silly, then remember, in Britain today, pictures of that hat are everywhere. On stonework, signs, documents and websites. The hat is still doing what the first bossy and brutal man who ever put it on meant it to do, conveying authority and asserting power. Part 1. Pre-Willy. Chapter 1. King Arthur. He didn't exist. That's the headline. It's a disappointing start, I know, but it's an early sign of how tricky history can be. England's, though more usually Britain's, but often Wales's and Cornwall's, sometimes Brittany's, most famous king turns out to be fictional. That's putting it politely. Gandalf is fictional, King Arthur is a lie. Some people will still say he might have existed, but the sort of person they say he might have been is so far removed from King Arthur in any of the forms we understand him that it feels like they're just saying he didn't exist in a different way. It's like they're saying, oh yeah, there was a real Superman, except he didn't have any actual superpowers and he dressed as a bat. For the avoidance of doubt and of a catastrophic collapse in listeners' confidence in the first chapter, let me make clear that I realise Batman also did not exist. Who do people say the real King Arthur might have been? Perhaps a Roman officer who served in Britain, or a Romano-British chieftain, or a Welsh king? Some senior figure who lived at any point from the 3rd to the 6th century. the 200s to the 500s. Someone like that, the idea goes, might have been the bit of real grit in the imagination oyster that turned into the Arthurian pearl. Personally, I don't think imagination oysters need real grit any more than metaphorical bonnets need real bees. What caused the Arthur Pearl was the persistent longing of humans of almost all eras and cultures to hark back to something better. It's a far more enduring psychological habit than a belief in progress. People found it much easier to believe in a rose-tinted view of the past than a utopian future. They still do. Hence, take back control and make America great again. For most of the period covered by this book, any claims or attempts by leaders to change or improve things are most persuasively labelled to the people of the time as restorations of some kind. Saying that something was totally new often played badly. The ultimate, most glorious restoration would be to the golden age of King Arthur. We get most of our sense of King Arthur from Geoffrey of Monmouth, who completed his Historia Regum Britanniae, History of the Kings of Britain, in 1138, and from Sir Thomas Malory, whose 15th century Le Morte d'Arthur, The Death of Arthur, was, in 1485, one of the first books to be printed in England. That gave the Arthur myth wider circulation. There's now been so much talk about King Arthur over the centuries that many people feel, like they do with ghosts, that there must be something in it. There is. It just happens to be deep-seated psychological need rather than historical reality. The story of Arthur reflects our longing as a species for the ancient, concealed and magical. Towards the end of Le Morte d'Arthur, Malory suggests the title is not the spoiler it seems. Yet some men say in many parts of England that King Arthur is not dead, but had gone by the will of our Lord Jesu into another place. And many men say that there is written upon his tomb this verse, Hic jacet Arthurus, rex quondam, rexque futurus. Here lies Arthur, the once and future king. This is great stuff, and poses a haunting and exciting question. Will King Arthur return? It's clever because, as well as being haunting and exciting, it's a leading question of the when did you start taking cocaine kind. Whether you answer yes or no, you've accidentally accepted the premise that Arthur existed. The dates of those two books explain why Arthur, supposedly a 5th or 6th century ruler, looks like a medieval king in most of the surviving imagery. To us, King Arthur is an oldie-worldy figure. To the people of the Middle Ages, he was in modern dress. They imagined him like a contemporary king, but less shit. A paragon of justice, might, and legitimacy. He could be whomever and whatever they needed. What he was king of, in the most real sense, is Albion. And what is Albion? Its poetic and ancient connotations go beyond merely being the old name for Britain. It's pretty much whatever you want it to be. An English Britain, a Welsh Britain, a Scottish Britain, a Celtic Britain, an ancient British Britain. A nice version of here. So, while King Arthur didn't exist, the idea of him is lurking, guiltily or inspiringly, in the minds of many of the rulers who did. Chapter 2. King King. Another thing that didn't exist in the 6th century was England. No one called it that for hundreds of years. It's impossible to know exactly how many years, though, as there was no official rebranding moment. It wasn't like when Royal Mail became Consignia, or Anderson Consulting became Accenture, or Consignia became Royal Mail. There wasn't a day when all the signs saying Britannia got taken down. There was no signage. Hardly anyone could read. Those last two sentences can be applied to most of human history, so I hope you're not expecting this book to be about anything nice. England was a word that gradually gained currency, like mansplain or staycation, and it was fully in use by the time William the Conqueror was king of it. I expect you've heard of him. Most people know that in 1066, William the Conqueror, not at that point so named, won the Battle of Hastings and became King of England. When it comes to the likely audience for this book, that most must rise to all. If there is anyone listening to this book who didn't already know that, I would love to hear from you, because you are genuinely delving into a genre that was previously of no interest. You, if you exist, and I bet you don't, are an absolute confounder of the algorithms. It would be like someone reading a biography of Elvis Presley who did not already know that he was a singer. What you are doing is probably more statistically remarkable than what William the Conqueror did. Perhaps that's where we should start. The Norman Conquest, the beginning of proper English history. You know, the normal sort, with the current monarch numbering. If Prince William becomes king and takes the name that people actually call him by as his regnal name, which they don't always, confusingly, cf. Edward David VIII and George Albert VI, he'll be William V, and that's a fifth where the conqueror is first. It's almost official that English history starts then. A few months before that first William's arrival on these shores, King Edward the Confessor died. His posthumous career was more glittering than his living one, because he became a saint. Trump's king, doesn't it? To be honest, I slightly disapprove of kings being made saints. It's like CEOs getting knighthoods, standing alongside all those dedicated charity volunteers who raised millions for incubators but only get MBEs. Still, there it is. Edward the Confessor makes saint, even though he was never burned to death or nailed to anything. And a saint in honour of whom a later King Edward was named. But that later one is still King Edward the First. Even the revered confessor, as with all English kings before William of Normandy, literally doesn't count. The only trouble with calling William the Conqueror the first king of England is that it's not what he called himself. It's not what he chose to identify as, you might say, if you happen to be living in the early 21st century. William would have said he was the rightful successor to the confessor, and not because he was the sort of idiot who assumed things were more true if they rhymed. I reckon that kind of thing makes an ass out of you and me. Edward the Confessor would have said that he was the rightful ruler from the royal house of Cherditch, which had consolidated its hold over what was beginning to be referred to as Englerland after expelling the Vikings a few times. Before that, it had ruled the kingdom of Wessex since its establishment by Cherditch himself, he was supposedly a person, in 519, soon after the arrival in Britain of the Anglo-Saxons, an umbrella term for various tribes from what is now North Germany and Denmark, who started turning up once the Roman Empire withdrew its legions around 410, leaving lots of vulnerable Romano-British dignitaries wondering who was going to service the central heating in their villas, plus a few not particularly tough local warlords, none of whom, as discussed, was in any meaningful way King Arthur, and all of whom had lived rather comfortably being looked after by the Roman Empire since it had taken the place over in the year 43. Shit, this history's going backwards. Although, if you think about it, that's the logical direction to go in. It's how archaeology works. You can't start with the Stone Age axes and work your way up through Roman pots to clay pipes and finally ration cards and an old Nokia. The starting point for our inquiries into the past is the present. Historical narratives proceeding chronologically are a bit like sets of directions that start with where you're going and then work their way back to where you are. But I'm not the guy who's going to overturn the long-standing tradition of chronological historical narratives. I'm not that kind of iconoclast. You should see what I'm wearing. I still use a fabric handkerchief, for God's sake. I'll try and start with the first English king and go from there. The Mists of Time. I'm going to throw a few names at you. Vortigern, Hengist and Horsa, Weha, Ashwin, Alla, another Alla spelt differently, Eda, Itchel, and finally Cherditch, whom I've already mentioned. You will be thrilled to hear that no one totally knows if any of these people existed, but it's more likely than King Arthur. If you like, you could say that King Arthur was based on one of them. Really, go ahead, there's no harm in it. But who were they based on? Why do we have these names, these noises? Have I made them up? No, I haven't. I like to think I'd have made them sound more plausible. They are the names that have emerged out of the mists of time as belonging to some early rulers in England. Yes, the mists of time. Deal with it. It's not a cop-out. That's the situation. There was very little in the way of record-keeping. Why do you think archaeologists got so excited when at Sutton Hoo they discovered the body of a king and a few trinkets in a rotten old boat? All of it dating from hundreds of years later than the complete buried Roman leisure centre they found in Bath. It's because it was a rare sign of what might have been going on in the 300 years after the Romans left. Otherwise, it's mainly rumour and guesswork. This is how the story goes. Notwithstanding the Caratacus and Boudicca-led resistance to the early days of Roman control, by the time the empire left, the ancient Britons had gone completely Stockholm syndrome. They loved the Romans. In fact, they'd become the Romano-British, and with the legions gone, their instinct was to try and keep things going in a nice, comfy Roman way. This strategy didn't work out. When the Western Roman Empire was collapsing, a lot of other things were going on. Huns, Goths and Vandals were moving around Europe in an upsetting way. In Britain, a king called Vortigern, but note that Vortigern means king in Brittonic, the ancient Britain's language, so I worry someone might have got confused, but maybe there really was this king, was beset by raids from the Picts, who came from what is now Scotland, and from the Scots, from what is now Ireland. I know that sounds willfully confusing, but there's nothing I can do about it. I imagine Vortigern looking anxiously out to sea over the North Kent marshes, trying to remember how to do up his toga. I also imagine a thick sea mist blowing in. I may be taking the mists of time thing a bit too literally. Baffled and terrified though he was, there's no reason to assume he didn't benefit from a normal amount of clear weather. Vortigern seems to have been a bit of a Thatcherite, a believer in a small state. The British had successfully outsourced their defence requirements for hundreds of comfortable years, and in the absence of those wonderfully professional legions, he was looking for another continental corporate body that might bid for the contract. Enter the brothers Hengist and Horsa. They were leading figures among the Anglo-Saxons over in Germania. Vortigern hired them, plus three ships full of their followers, to come and sort out the security situation in Britannia. I don't know how and when the deal was done, mists of time, etc., but they duly turned up, probably in the 430s, knocked a few Picts' heads together, and then promptly turned on their employers. Cue the arrival of many other Angles, Saxons and Jutes. The Jutes don't make it into the adjective, perhaps from a combination of mishearing and anti-Semitism. They gradually took over what is now, thanks to them, called England, setting up several kingdoms. Hengist became the first king of Kent, Horsa died in battle fighting Vortigern, and now we can make sense of some of those other names. Waeha was the first king of the East Angles, Ashwin of the East Saxons, one of the Allas of the South Saxons, the other Alla of Deira, and Ida of Benicia. Deira and Benicia later become the kingdom of Northumbria. Itchel of Mercia, and Cherditch of the West Saxons. There's no need to remember any of that, there's a high chance it's bullshit. And the rest, after a few more centuries of mists of time, is history at last. That's a lot of potential first English kings. We're in an obscure region where truth and fiction, like the land and the marsh and the North Sea across which the Anglo-Saxons sailed, merge. Hengist and Horsa smack of fiction. The two brothers and the three ships, often referred to as the three keels, are very storyish. The brothers are reminiscent of Romulus and Remus, another foundation myth laced with notions of betrayal. And three keels are always turning up in Anglo-Saxon stories, much like men bursting through doors holding guns in film noir. There will have been early Anglo-Saxon big shots. The kingdoms these kings supposedly founded certainly came to exist. But the details of who those men really were have been forgotten. Don't be afraid of the dark. A remarkable amount of forgetting about stuff went on in the 200 or 300 years following the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. People at the time forgot what had just happened, and because there are few reliable written sources, posterity did too. There is only a grim sense that everything went down the drain, or would have done if the drainage infrastructure hadn't fallen into disrepair. And as a result, those centuries are commonly known as the Dark Ages. Academic consensus has turned against that term in recent years because that's what academics are like. Their favourite thing is saying that previous academics have got it wrong, even if it's just about the naming of an era. At one point, Dark Ages was used to refer to the whole medieval period up to when the Renaissance kicked off in the 15th century. That is simplistic, as well as being poor brand management of the late Middle Ages, which I don't know about you, but I think of as being absolutely slathered with heraldry. Perhaps I'm basing it too much on the eye-bruising technicolour of Laurence Olivier's film of Henry V, but I feel like there's altogether too many shiny trumpety things and maidens with pointy hats and youths with pointy shoes to be dark. Daft, maybe, but not dark. Plus, there was a lot more going on that we know about by then, so using the term Dark Ages about that era speaks more of some people having gone a bit nuts about how amazing the Renaissance was, as if we might as well not bother with any history until Leonardo started doodling helicopters. The term has also been used to cover the centuries from the Romans leaving England right up to 1066, which again doesn't seem right. The 9th, 10th and 11th centuries were not, by modern standards, at all pleasant, but they were different from the 5th and 6th centuries, for which dark feels eerily appropriate. Also, there were parts of the world where things were going swimmingly in the 5th and 6th centuries, so it's silly to use it about those places. But England, or the bit of the world that's now called England but wasn't then, is not one of those places. With the withdrawal of Roman protection, society went to shit. Quite literally, since it heralded a 1400-year hiatus in the construction of sewers. There was vertiginous civic and economic decline. Manufacturing collapsed. Coins were no longer minted. Population numbers went into freefall, and not because people were choosing to have fewer children in order to focus on their careers. Villas were abandoned, and all over the country, hordes of coins and valuables were buried in the hope of being dug up by their owners when the situation improved. It was a vain hope. Instead, they were dug up by metal detectorists over 1,000 years after the owners had all rotted to dust. A civilian population, which under Roman rule had been forbidden to bear arms, put up a feeble resistance in the face of the warrior peoples arriving from all directions. This might have made less of a difference to subsistence peasants, who'd always lived in, to us, unimaginable rural penury, but it screwed anyone even a tiny bit better off than that. Anyone who wasn't screwed already. It was apocalyptic. If that's not reason enough to use the term Dark Ages, I dread to think what we're saving it for. Particularly stupid is the implication that the expression is somehow rude to the age, as if an age can get offended, as if the people whose standard of living plummeted with the retreat of the legions would mind or object. I reckon they'd agree that the time they were living in was dire. I don't see that it's in any way more respectful to gloss over that. What's the point of showing bland respect for all the ages? Oh, they're all lovely, all the ages. Let's not be rude by labelling one of them dark. The rubble and leaky roofs that no one could remember how to repair are, in their way, just as spiffing as building the Parthenon and inventing democracy. Let's say a big well done to all the people of history for being there at all. We won't get all analytical and judgy. It's patronising to start telling people that just because they all totally forgot how to do running water or dress stone and loads of people died, that's not a lovely positive choice they've made. This example of civilization suddenly getting markedly worse by any meaningful definition of the word is extremely interesting and worthy of note. The fact that history took such a sudden and, yes, dark turn is important to emphasise. It's something every society might profit from remembering. I don't mean to be a doom monger, but we could do with it now. A big threat to our current civilization is the persistent post-Victorian assumption of progress. This Whig interpretation of history has been regularly debunked ever since the term was coined by the historian Herbert Butterfield in 1931. A tough year for believers in things getting better. Still, most of us unreflectingly go along with it. You hear it in the way people rebuke each other for prejudiced remarks by saying, "Come on, it's the 21st century," as if the passage of time inevitably brings with it ethical improvements. The pejorative word dated shows how ingrained is our assumption that human civilization gets better over time. It probably has recently, technologically at least, but it's not a given. Is assuming that things improve the best way of ensuring they will? I doubt it. A healthy fear of societal cataclysm may be a good technique for avoiding it. The going-to-shit qualities of the Dark Ages are important to emphasise. They're a handy warning. Plus, it's a cool and attractive thing about studying that period. You don't specialise in it for the architecture or the plumbing. Chapter 3. King Ceolwulf of Northumbria. For me, the misty, dark, unknowable aura of 5th, 6th and 7th century Britain is an enormous draw. Murkiness with a fleeting glimpse of gold. A crown, a sword, a hoard of Roman coins buried by a rich Romano Briton fleeing his villa in panic. What was that movement in the fog? A dragon, a dinosaur, a galley full of legionaries hurrying away? The sense of mystery and loss is overwhelming, long before anyone thought of inventing King Arthur. Where cum Meg, where cum Margo? That's the Anglo-Saxon language, also known as Old English. It contains hardly any words inherited from Brittonic, which suggests there was eerily little cordial interaction between the Anglo-Saxons and the people they displaced. It's a snippet from a poem called The Wanderer that's preserved in a 10th century manuscript, but is believed to have been written much earlier. It's from a bit that translates as this. Where is that horse now? Where the rider? Where is the hoard-sharer? Where is the house of the feast? Where is the hall's uproar? There's a powerful sense of missing something, which is a strangely sophisticated emotion to have been preserved for us from what, in our terms, seems like such a primitive and poorly documented culture. Longing and bereavement are surprisingly high in the mix compared to, say, glory or sex or anger. From our perspective, this little medieval society is barely getting started, and yet it's already steeped in as much moist-eyed nostalgia as last orders at a British Legion club on the anniversary of VE Day. "The work of giants is decaying," laments another poem, The Ruin. It's reflecting on some crumbling Roman buildings, probably those in Bath. "Bright were the castle buildings, many the bathing halls, high the abundance of gables, great the noise of the multitude, many a mead hall full of festivity, until fate the mighty changed that." A mead hall full of festivity sounds a bit down market for a Roman night out, and the reference to castle buildings is poignant. Magnificent though they are, the buildings aren't fortified. They didn't need to be for most of Roman rule. The Romans established reliable public order, a feat not achieved again in Britain for well over 1,000 years. This was a luxury the Anglo-Saxons couldn't imagine. Still, the point is well made. I suppose it's hard to live amid so much decaying infrastructure without feeling a bit glum. The good news. Some people managed it, though. King Ceolwulf of Northumbria, for example, and his favourite historian, the Venerable Bede. They lived in the late 7th and early 8th centuries, and they're quite upbeat about life. Plus, they definitely existed. You can take that as read from now on. The mists of time have lifted considerably. Bede is one of the main mist lifters. He was a monk in the Abbey of Jarrow in Northumbria, and his Ecclesiastical History of the English People was the most famous thing to come out of Jarrow until a march protesting against unemployment in 1936. Bede's book predates the march by a cool 1,205 years and is one of the main reasons we know anything at all about Dark Age England. He dedicated it to the King of Northumbria at the time, Ceolwulf. Bede and Ceolwulf are also both saints. I don't disapprove of Ceolwulf's kingly sainthood as much as Edward the Confessor's because he abdicated in 737 and lived as a monk for the rest of his life, so he put the hours in, sanctity-wise. As did Bede, though the sobriquet Venerable seems to have stuck to him despite achieving higher-ranking saintly status. These things happen. People never really said Admiral Kirk. I have genuinely, literally read Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People. So you don't have to. I'd take me up on that if I were you. It may be important, but it's boring. It was written in Latin, but an English translation was on the reading list I was given before going to university, so I gave it a go. In my 19-year-old arrogance, what I felt was silly about Bede was that he characterised an age of comparative barbarism and misery as one in which humanity had advanced. He only did this, ridiculously it seemed to me then, because it was a good period for the church, an institution with which he was obsessed. In England, for the 100 years or so before he wrote his history, Christianity had been on the march. That's why Bede didn't see the situation in the same bleak terms as whoever wrote The Wanderer and The Ruin. I felt he was just plain wrong. Looking back, I realise I was a bit hard on him. Religion both bored and unsettled me, and yet my history teachers were constantly exhorting me not to ignore it. In an A-level history essay, I was taught there should always be at least one paragraph on the church. I would dutifully stick one in, but I didn't really get it. I was an agnostic who didn't like thinking about religion because I hoped there was a God but didn't have the confidence to commit. Plus, the trappings of religion felt a bit embarrassing and weird, like properly putting on a French accent when saying things in French. My religious views haven't significantly moved on, but what I am slightly more capable of understanding is that, the existence or non-existence of God notwithstanding, religion is real and powerful and not just something from the olden days. Moreover, in the olden days, it was, in pretty much every society, a bigger deal than we can possibly imagine. Christianity, for Bede, wasn't merely something he was massively into or he solemnly exhorted other people to adhere to. It was everything. It was the real underlying truth of existence, like science is today. It was very much not like religion is today, even for those who are very religious. If we don't accept that, we can't begin to understand the times he lived in and the attitude he took. So So for him, a history of England that wasn't entirely focused on the spread of the Christian faith would be pointless because nothing else mattered. This was a prevalent view at the time, and one that gave a brutal existence meaning, purpose, and hope. I'm 30 years nearer the grave than when I first read Bede, and much less confident in rejecting this worldview. The bad news. The Romans had been Christian by the end. Originally, they'd been polytheistic and inclined to use Christians as lion food, but in 313, the Emperor Constantine put a stop to all that and declared he was a Christian himself. Soon, Christianity was the empire's dominant religion, which meant that the Romano-British were Christian. Hence, King Arthur was Christian, even though he didn't exist. Over on the continent, Roman rule may not have survived, but Roman religion did. Tribes like the Goths and the Franks were content to live in Roman cities and were soon worshipping the Romans' lovely big single god. Despite repeatedly sacking Rome itself, these upwardly mobile barbarians were keen to live an increasingly Roman life. It was as if they were collectively willing into existence the expression "when in Rome." It was different in Britain. The invading Anglo-Saxons weren't interested in Jesus or a free limoncello. The Britons were driven west, some remaining Christian and some reverting to a sort of Iron Age paganism. Cities were abandoned and the newcomers settled down to a rural existence throughout the southeast of the island, hurling the occasional Roman brick at one another. The Anglo-Saxons stuck with the form of paganism they'd brought over from the continent, which was a nice little bunch of gods who, as a helpful mnemonic, the days of the week are named after. There's Woden, king of the gods and god of wisdom, beardy guy with a cloak, after whom Wednesday is named. Then Thunor, their version of Thor, who you might know from the Marvel Universe. He is god of thunder, which feels like a comparatively small brief, and the etymological root of Thursday. Then it's Frigg. I don't know if the 1970s expression for wanking derives from this goddess's name, though it seems unlikely as her portfolio includes marriage and childbirth, but the word Friday definitely does, and I think we can all agree that the end of the working week is a lovely time for a jolly good frig. The god of war, Tu, accounts for Tuesday. Sunday and Monday are the sun and the moon, and weirdly, Saturday is named after the Roman god Saturn, which feels incongruous, a bit like having a parish church called St. Mohammed's. Back to the mortals. Whatever the actual names of those early Anglo-Saxon big shots, it seems unlikely that any of them were kings in the sense we understand the word. What probably happened is that the new settlers appropriated areas of land, and then, people being reliably unpleasant, some of those settlers would start pushing others around, demanding tribute and offering protection. Gradually, by the same method used by drug gangs to divide up LA, a system of government emerged. The local hard guy had to stay in with the provincial hard guy, who had to curry favour with the regional hard guy. It was out of this unjust and lawless maelstrom of violence that the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms coalesced. The kingly legitimacy affected by the relatively settled handful of rulers and regimes that were in existence by Bede's day is no more respectable than a mafia boss adopting the title Dom. It's just dressing up a system based on violence in order to economise on violence. If you can get people to start calling you sire and obeying you because they think that's the way of the world, or somehow right and proper and endorsed by God or the gods, then you don't have to raise so many bands of heavies or armies and incur all the risks and costs involved in asserting your supposed royalty at the point of a sword or knuckle. In case this isn't sounding grim enough, in the 530s to 550s there was a period of extreme cold weather, famine and plague. A series of volcanic eruptions in what is now Iceland threw up dust clouds that blocked the sun and made the crops fail all over Europe. Outbreaks of plague followed, probably because everyone who hadn't starved to death was hungry and cold and sad. All this suffering must have hastened the process by which power was consolidated into fewer and nastier hands. Many desperate people will have accepted the protection offered by anyone tough with a bit of spare food. The true roots of English kingship are therefore so far away from the Arthurian ideal, it's actually funny. The notion that pious legitimacy was the foundation of the institution is totally false. Everything those early kings possessed, they or their ancestors had either stolen or demanded with menaces. The veneer of legitimacy was retrospectively applied in order to keep hold of all the power and wealth. By the late 6th century and early 7th, pretending to be a king was all the rage. The vague regions of strongman influence started to coalesce into kingdoms, and the idea of a Bretwalder emerged. The Bretwalder, which literally means either wide ruler or Britain ruler, was supposedly the dominant Anglo-Saxon king at any given time. We don't know if the term was used contemporaneously, it may be a 9th century invention, but the notion of being a dominant ruler must have been understood. It would have been the gold medal in the Olympics of unpleasantness that these violent men were competing in. Ruler status was all about power deriving from violence, combined with a growing sense that a bit of regal showiness helped keep inferiors in their place and intimidate rival kings. So they energetically asserted their importance in other ways. That's what the elaborate burial at Sutton Hoo was all about. They also built huge wooden halls full of booze and smoke and warriors. As you can imagine, they burned down, or were burned down, with tedious regularity, but they were major symbols of the new king's power. A king could put a roof over your head, at least for a few hours, and keep you warm and fill your stomach. In those bleak days, that was all it took. Rather poignantly, the modern English word lord derives from the Old English hlafod, meaning bread giver. In Roman times, there'd been circuses too. For God's sake? This was the environment into which Christianity was reintroduced by a monk called Augustine, now referred to as Saint Augustine of Canterbury, not because he got his head handed to him on a plate or was killed in a way that inspired a firework, but because it all went so well. He was one of the getting things done sort of saint rather than the getting done in kind. He'd been sent from Rome by Pope Gregory I to convert the Anglo-Saxons, landed in Kent in 597, and was given a cautious welcome by its king, Ethelbert, the dominant southern English ruler at the time. Ethelbert already had a Christian wife, Berta, so he was less inclined than many of his contemporaries to murder Christians on sight. Queen Berta had been born a princess in the Christian Frankish kingdom across the Channel in what is now France, which may give you a clue to where the name came from. And she had married the barbarous pagan Ethelbert on condition that she be allowed to practice her faith. Ethelbert ignored his wife's funny ways until they were explained to him by a man from Rome, and suddenly he was into them. Ethelbert's conversion gave Christianity its first foothold among the Anglo-Saxons, but the flame of Romano-British Christianity was being kept alight in western parts of Great Britain. In fact, this Celtic church, as it tends to be referred to, had converted Ireland in the 5th century. It's odd that it's called Celtic, because its root is as Roman as the Pope's church. It had spread to Britain because of the Roman Empire, but had then become cut off because of the Anglo-Saxons. Without the Wi-Fi of the Empire, the app hadn't been getting the updates. Different practices had started to emerge. Don't let the last sentence fool you into thinking it was anything interesting, like human sacrifice or Jesus being a Martian. The main things were a different tonsure, monk's hairdo, and a different way of calculating the date of Easter. The argument among prelates about this last tedious issue was so interminable, it feels like they were just trying to prove they believed in eternal life. It took the best part of a century for the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms to convert, largely to the papal brand of Christianity. It was a century of relentless, brutal fighting. A succession of kings, some Christian and some pagan, established themselves as Bretwalder, but they almost all died in battle, usually fighting against the man destined to be the next dominant Anglo-Saxon, though there was also fighting against British, Irish and Pictish rulers. I'm not sure the violence really had anything to do with Christianity, even if it was often used as justification. There'd been loads of fighting before Augustine turned up, and the arrival of Christianity certainly didn't put a stop to it, or even a dent in it. The whole vague Christian niceness agenda, love thy neighbour as thyself, do as you would be done by, etc., seemed to have absolutely zero impact, but neither was it the real cause of all the unpleasantness. If you're trying to decide whether religion is a good or a bad thing, and people often claim they are, though they have usually already decided, early Anglo-Saxon England is a useful time and place to look at. These days, atheists often cite the murderous religious wars in history as proof that believing in supreme beings is a damaging and regrettable practice. The fact that they're convinced none of those supreme beings exist incentivizes them to make this argument. Personally, I'm not convinced of the universe's godlessness, but even if we assume the atheists are right about that, I doubt religion is responsible for as much death as is claimed. Some people love to fight and steal and dominate. That's the key. There are assholes among us, and given half a chance, they're going to start some sort of trouble out of ruthless self-interest, or bloodlust, or both. The prevailing ethos of any surrounding society is almost always that you're not supposed to kill people without a good reason, or at least some sort of reason. But the assholes are clever, so they come up with reasons. To deeply religious societies, religious differences sound like a very convincing reason for killing people. But that doesn't mean the killing wouldn't have been happening anyway. If St. Augustine hadn't provided the reason, Woden would, or family feuds, or just plain xenophobia. That said, a lot of the people fighting in 7th century England sincerely believed they were doing it in Jesus' name, or alternatively, to wipe out the heretical cult of Jesus that was pissing off Woden, Frigg, Thunor and the rest. But the fighting would have been happening regardless. Violence is a constant. The religious views are just the accompanying spin. The largest avowedly atheistic societies in all human history, the various communist states of the 20th century, didn't stint on murder. You could argue that under Stalin or Mao or Ceausescu, communism effectively was a religion, just without the promise of eternal life. That's a fair point, but it extends the anti-religious argument to cover pretty much any sort of big concept or philosophy. The logical conclusion is that people should, in general, refrain from getting any big ideas into their heads and restrict themselves to philosophies on the level of "it takes all sorts" and "funny old world." Though before you knew it, there'd be a war over whether the world is deemed to be funny peculiar or funny ha-ha. My point is that I don't think religions are themselves to blame for all the violence in the name of religion, though it has to be said that the religions also totally fail to stop it. So, is religion a good or a bad thing? Perhaps the answer is no. Christian? Well, you know, just Christmas and Easter and when I'm committing genocide. Bede and King Ceolwulf definitely thought religion was a good thing. For them, the advance of Christianity made sense of everything. The horridness and occasional goodness was all part of some plan. It was a nice plan, even if it was counterintuitive and tricky to unpick. A king who abdicates to become a monk is a very different sort of person from the warlords of a century or more earlier who came up with the notion of kingship to dignify their violent amassing of power and wealth. There's a sincerity to Ceolwulf's piety, an implication of duty that comes with his abdication that would have seemed very strange to those self-proclaimed kings. He comes across as decent, is I suppose what I'm saying, though they seem more of a laugh. In the 7th century, there are several rulers who were splendidly cynical in their use of Christianity. For example, King Radwald of East Anglia, who died in 624 and is probably the main Sutton Hoo corpse, hedged his bets by building a temple with two altars, one to the pagan gods and one to Christ. Bede is predictably contemptuous of this, and given a moment's thought, it's not as canny a strategy as it initially sounds. Whether it turned out to be God or the gods who really existed, you imagine he or they would be pissed off at this equivocation when Radwald turned up in the afterlife. Perhaps that's why he thought it important to be buried with all that treasure. He reckoned he might have to tip heavily on arrival. Similarly, the Christian British King Cadwallon of Gwynedd, who reigned until 634 when he was killed in battle by the also Christian Anglo-Saxon King Oswald of Northumbria, had, a year earlier, been very happy to make an alliance with the very, very pagan King Pender of Mercia in order to defeat Oswald's predecessor, the Christian King Edwin of Northumbria. That's quite a sentence, I know. The point I'm trying to make is that even by the time Christianity was very much around, it wasn't necessarily the dominant factor. Another example. Later in the century, the brutal King Cadwallader of Wessex was, with the enthusiastic support of St. Wilfrid, happy to use Christianity as an excuse for slaughtering everyone on the Isle of Wight, at that point the last pagan Anglo-Saxon kingdom, and taking the place over. But Cadwallader himself wasn't baptised Christian. He was hedging his bets as well, though to be fair on him, he then abdicated and went on a pilgrimage to Rome, where he was baptised by Pope Sergius I in 689, before promptly dying. 50 to 100 years later, leaders like Ceolwulf are a lot more serious about it, even when they didn't go on to become monks. A bit like smoking to look cool and then becoming addicted, medieval kings soon came to believe their own Christ-proclaiming hype. Most of the rulers after this time, brutal and self-interested though they may have been, were genuinely God-fearing. They turned that fear to their advantage by asserting that the very fact they were kings was a sign of celestial favour. Ceremonial elements were gradually introduced, following trends already established on the continent where there hadn't been such a post-Roman pagan blip. The Old Testament mentions kings having crowns put on them and being anointed, and the word Christ comes from the Greek meaning anointed one. So the way of legitimizing, even sanctifying, secular power under the big new religion was obvious. Hence, back in the 5th century, the emperors of the surviving eastern half of the Roman Empire, which these days gets called the Byzantine Empire, had started getting themselves crowned by the Patriarch of Constantinople. This gave ecclesiastical endorsement to that ancient pagan office, and the trend had been spread westwards by the cool Byzantine soft power. In the 7th century, the Visigoth kings of Spain started being crowned and anointed in holy oil, and by the middle of the 8th, the practice had been adopted by the Frankish kings, who held sway in most of what is now France, the Low Countries and Western Germany. This need outwardly to assert a massive holy link between God, Christ, and some beardy guy with a sword and a colossal sense of entitlement was becoming entrenched on the mainland and followed Christianity into the lands of the Anglo-Saxons. Christianity and the right to rule were welded together. By the time of Bede, for a king to remain unbaptized, as Cadwallader had been, would be as unlikely and egregious a lapse in professional housekeeping as a presenter of the One Show forgetting to renew their television license. Chapter 4. King Offa of Mercia. When my wife and I are visiting a nice town or village for the first time, the question we always ask is, where's the bit? That's what we're looking for, the main bit, the nice bit, the bit you're supposed to go and walk round where the stuff is. The bit that, once seen, gives you the authority to say you've been to the place. Tourists judge a place by its bit, even if locals eschew the bit because they're inured to its beauties and obsessed with the difficulty of parking. Anything from a substantial village to a small city will have one bit. Sorrento in Italy, where we have spent a few holidays, is blessed with two bits, and we'd been going there for several years before we discovered the second one. It's the Old Port. Metropolises like London and New York can have several bits, and LA has no real bit at all. But quite large places still have only one. Cambridge and Bath, for example, have relatively sizable bits, but only one each. The bit isn't really the place, though. It's only a small part of the place. It's just the bit you don't want to miss, because it's most characteristic of the place. Well, in the history of Anglo-Saxon England, we finally found the bit. It's the mid to late 8th century. That's the main bit, the normal bit, when the era of Anglo-Saxon England was properly up and running, but hadn't started to run out. During this bit, there were several stable kingdoms broadly covering the area soon to be known as England, one of which was, at any given time, in the ascendancy. The Britons had been pushed back into the west, parts of what is now Devon and Cornwall, and pretty much all of what is now Wales. In fact, the words Wales and Welsh are derived from the words the Germanic-speaking tribes all over Europe gave to the retreating and cowed citizens of the collapsing Roman Empire. Wallas, which meant foreigners or strangers, from which we get Walloon, the French-speaking Belgians, and Gaul, of Asterix the Gaul, somehow the W turned into a G, as well as the Old English Walch, which became Wales and Welsh. Hence the modern French for Wales is Pays de Gaul, country of the Gauls, which is massively confusing. France, Gaul, is the actual country of the Gauls, you'd think. It's almost like the French are calling Wales France, as if to the French, the Welsh seem more French than the French. And having been to both France and Wales many times, that strikes me as an eccentric opinion. Meanwhile, the Welsh word for Wales, Cymru, derives from a Brittonic word meaning fellow countrymen. Strangers or fellow countrymen. The Welsh for Wales basically means us, and the English for it means them. Us and them. That sums up the relations between the Britons and the Anglo-Saxons at this point. Sharing a religion only seemed to divide them further, and there were persistent differences over how to calculate the date of Easter, despite the extreme disinclination of people on both sides to send one another festive eggs. My strong advice is not to worry about the specifics of this difference, because it is complicated and unimportant. Basically, the Celtic Church calculated the date of Easter Sunday on an 84-year cycle, while the Roman Church, that the Anglo-Saxons had largely adopted, did it on a 19-year cycle. If that information is not enough to put you off further inquiry, then I think you should seriously consider stopping listening to this audiobook and developing a drug habit. Northern Europe enjoyed a significant economic recovery in the late 7th and 8th centuries that enriched the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms but didn't much benefit the Britons, who had too many Anglo-Saxons between them and all that trade. This further boosted the Anglo-Saxons' increasing feelings of communality, of a racial and linguistic bond from which the Britons were explicitly excluded. The two sides defined themselves against one another, and the Anglo-Saxon world was buoyed up by a consequent sense of unity. This unifying enmity finds its physical embodiment in Offa's Dyke. You may have heard of it. People do walks along it these days. It's a very long earthwork, a ditch with an embankment that runs roughly along the Welsh-English border, or, at time of construction, the Mercia-Powys border. It's been called Offa's Dyke since time immemorial, and unusually for something like that, it's probably correctly named and was indeed constructed by order of King Offa of Mercia. People don't exactly know why. The answer, just for fun, can be ruled out, because constructing a ditch that long would take a huge amount of effort and resources today. For a small 8th-century kingdom, it would have felt as difficult as acquiring a nuclear deterrent. Was it supposed to be a deterrent, a defensive military line? Maybe, but it wouldn't be a very good one, unless it was manned, and it doesn't seem likely that it was. It's too long. Assuming an invading army didn't require disabled access, it wouldn't stop them. They could scramble over it. It would have made stealing livestock tricky, as herding lots of animals back over it would be difficult. Also, it will have been symbolically powerful. Perhaps it was just literally drawing a line, asserting power. The Anglo-Saxons hold sway up to here. When Offa was king, from 757 to 796, Mercia was the dominant kingdom, and had been for some time, certainly for most of the reign of his almost immediate predecessor, Ethelbald, who had been king since 716. I say almost immediate because another man, Beonred, ruled briefly and unsuccessfully between Ethelbald's assassination, possibly orchestrated by Beonred, and his own, definitely orchestrated by Offa. If you're looking for a way to remember the chronological order of dominance of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, and you might be, you could use it as the basis for a series of internet passwords. It's this. Start at the bottom and then go round anti-clockwise. That's not how the Anglo-Saxons remembered it, though, as none of them had ever seen a clock. It starts at Sussex, back in the mists of time, when Alla was king. He was supposedly the first Bretwelder, but may not have existed at all, so this Sussexian dominance could be fictional. Then we move into fact and round to Kent, when Ethelbert was in charge, and then to East Anglia under Radwald. After that, there were several dominant kings of Northumbria, but this was fading in the time of Bede, to be replaced by, we're moving down the left now, Mercia, which we've just got to, and finally, spoiler alert, Wessex. Of the seven kingdoms that later historians, in an effort to tidy up this disordered era, referred to as the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy, only Essex doesn't seem to have had its moment in the sun, even in myth. This slightly spoils the mnemonic, but there it is. Perhaps we should just pretend that Essex briefly ruled the roost between Kent and East Anglia, and I suspect there'll be insufficient evidence to comprehensively refute the claim. An offer you can't refuse. Boom! I've dropped the pun. I couldn't help it. It's been hanging over me all chapter. My justification for making it is, bear with me, that Offa asserted dominance over, or took over, all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms except Northumbria. For those kingdoms, King Offa's dominance was what he offered, and if you refused Offa's offer, he would respond with lethal violence. So you can't refuse it. It's actually a completely apposite pun, and on reflection, I'm extremely proud of myself. One of the main reasons Mercia was able to dominate was that it controlled London. That seems a bit strange. Mercia's heartland was the Midlands. The word is still used to refer to that part of England, as in the West Mercia Police that arrests people in Herefordshire, Shropshire and Worcestershire. London is in the southeast. To a modern perspective, it is the dominant core of the southeast. The south and east of Anglo-Saxon England were dense with other kingdoms, Kent,